Our first reading is taken from the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament. You can follow it and check up on me if you like on page 600 in the Church Bibles. A passage entitled False and True Worship, Isaiah 58, starting at verse 1. Shout out, do not hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Announce to my people their rebellion, to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet day after day they seek me and delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments. They delight to draw near to God. Why do we fast, but you do not see? Why humble ourselves, but you do not notice? Look, you serve your own interest on your fast day and oppress all your workers. Look, you fast only to quarrel and fight and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day to humble oneself? Is it to bow down the head like a bulrush and to lie in sackcloth and ashes? Will you call this a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? Is not this the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them, and not to hide yourself from your own kin. Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rearguard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry for help, and he will say, "Here I am." If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness, and your gloom be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places, and make your bones strong. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. Your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in. Thanks be to God.
The next reading is from Matthew 5, verses 13 to 20. They're the words of Jesus and following on from the Beatitudes that we were thinking about last week. Page 786. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven.
What are we called to do as disciples? What kind of people are we called to be? Well, apart from the fact that Rabbit maybe gives us a clue, in many ways we get right to the heart of such questions when we take a look at Matthew chapter 5. At the beginning of the chapter, we find Jesus effectively taking his disciples on retreat. Now, it's not the bit we read today, it's the earlier part of the chapter, but verse 1 of Matthew 5, where when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him. And then there on the mountain, Jesus teaches these disciples. And that's why we often call this section of Matthew the Sermon on the Mount. It stretches across three whole chapters, chapters 5, 6, and 7. And it starts with those sayings that we often refer to as the Beatitudes, and then continues with today's reading, before going on to cover a whole range of other things. Being taught to be a disciple is important. Rowan Williams once said this: the disciple is not there to jot down ideas and then go away and think about them. The disciple is where he or she is in order to be changed, so that the way in which he or she sees and experiences the whole world changes. Bishop Michael Curry, famous for giving the address at Harry and Meghan's wedding, says this: discipleship is about focusing on Jesus, following in the footsteps of Jesus, becoming his hands and feet in the world. Discipleship is about loving as Jesus loves, giving as Jesus gives, forgiving as Jesus forgives, welcoming and including as Jesus welcomes and includes, doing justice and loving mercy and walking humbly with God like Jesus. In verses 13 and 14 of the passage that we have just heard from Matthew 5, Jesus uses two metaphors to describe his followers, his disciples, and to say what they are, what they do. They're very everyday things. They are the salt of the earth, and they are the light of the world. The first metaphor, that of salt, carries the suggestion that they are there to bring out goodness. It is outward looking. Disciples are to make a difference in the context in which they are set. Salt makes food taste good. At least that's what it does for the most part. That's not what happens if you put too much salt on. That rather spoils the taste. But perhaps the key thing then to say is that salt makes a profound difference, which is just what disciples are called to do. One of the dangers is that it is quite easy for us who are disciples to forget what kind of difference it is that we ought to be making. And the key to that can be seen as lying in the earlier part of the chapter, the Beatitudes, those great sayings that we hear and know so well. Discipleship is about creating a different kind of society, and a society that lines up with God's kingdom. A society that disrupts the status quo by valuing the dispossessed, caring for those who suffer loss, seeking to do justice, showing mercy, having integrity, being peacemakers, standing for truth. Discipleship that doesn't do that is like salt that has lost its taste. The second metaphor, that of light, helps us to think about the role of the disciples as a gathered community. Light enables us to see things. Jesus tells his followers that they are the light of the world, and that this light needs to be seen, not hidden. We often interpret this as meaning that we are not to hide our gifts and talents by covering them up. And we use this to encourage people to step forward and offer the service that they can, to use their gifts, to use their talents. And that's great, it's right. Jesus encourages his disciples to bring light to a dark and broken world. That's the task. Taking God's love out into the world. Archbishop William Temple is often quoted as saying, "The church is the only organization on earth that exists for those who are not its members." In order for the light to be seen where it is needed, we need to be prepared to go into the darkness. It's the not keeping your light on under a bushel thing. "Oh, I couldn't possibly do that." We say, well, maybe you could. If we don't let our light be seen, then it won't achieve what's needed. We need the light to penetrate the darkness. Now again, it's about getting it right. Annie Dillard writes, "You do not have to sit outside in the dark. If, however, you want to look at the stars, you will find that darkness is necessary. The dark places exist and are needed. In one sense, we should take the light of Christ everywhere. But actually, we can't do everything. It's important to think about where we should be taking Christ's light. And to pause long enough to listen to what God is saying to us. What's the little bit of stuff that God is asking us to do? Because it might be good, we would think, if we on our own could save the world, but actually when we think about it, we know that's not going to happen. But we can make just a little bit of difference. The impact of the light is that others see the kingdom actions that we undertake. The images of light and salt emphasize the missional identity and lifestyle of the disciples. Both salt and light can go a long way. Both light and salt can make a big difference. Salt brings out the taste, just as the disciples should demonstrate God's way of seeing and doing things. And light, quite simply, enables us to see. And because we can see, we can do stuff. That's the call. Do God's stuff. I'm sure we've all stumbled along in the darkness. I had a good idea. It was one of my New Year's resolutions. It's not going too well, but that's what happens to New Year's resolutions, isn't it? I thought I'd try and do more exercise, more walking. And so one of my theories is that on those, and they are very few days, that I'm going to the office in Whittlesford. And I'm not going anywhere else. I'll get the train. The station, as some of you will know, in Shelford is right beside our house, so there's not a lot of walking to do there. But there's a nice walk, about 20 minutes or so, from the station in Whittlesford to the office. And so I did that. And I set off one day early in January, which was great, and it was fine, and I enjoyed the walk. The thing was going home. It gets dark early. And I don't know whether any of you have ever walked along that bit of the road in Whittlesford towards the station in the dark. It's not the easiest thing to do. I did the second time I did it, I got my phone out and used the torch facility. We need the light. And the light just makes all the difference. Because I did it both ways. I did manage it and I didn't do anything, fall over or anything. But walking along there in the dark, I was quite... And it wasn't helped by the fact that there were a couple of guys out running. And they suddenly came past. When you're in the dark, that's quite frightening. Having the light just made all the difference. That's how it is. And we should be making all the difference in that way. Because we are the light. Let your light shine before others, so that they can see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. That's discipleship. That's what it means to to be a follower of Jesus. The second section of today's Gospel reading, verses 17 to 20, offers an important reminder of how Jesus connects with the Law and the Prophets. It actually develops the theme of what it means to be salt and light. It's a reminder that those who might think that Jesus and his followers turned their backs on Judaism, on the Law, have got it wrong. They didn't. Certainly Jesus didn't. Yes, Jesus was bringing something new. There is a very real sense in which that is so, but Jesus is very clear that what he is doing is grabbing hold of the core values of the Law. Let's try and understand this by putting it in context. Jesus is teaching his disciples. He's telling them how to live, and a large part of that is about how they relate to and are seen by the people whom they encounter on a daily basis. Now let's think of at least a couple of the groups of the day who people, disciples, would meet. And I can imagine that there would be some zealots around in most communities. One of the disciples is identified himself as a zealot. At least there would be some sympathetic to that view. They were the freedom fighters of the day. Remember that Palestine was occupied territory. The Romans were in charge and they did pretty well what they wanted. Even the most law-abiding Jew must have hoped for and prayed for the overthrow of the occupying Roman army. The zealots were the activists. If there was going to be a revolution, it would almost certainly start with them. And they would be on the lookout for any opportunity to undermine the occupying Romans. And what is it that Jesus is going to say before the end of this chapter? If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go the second mile. That's not just about anyone. Because the class of people who would make you go a mile carrying their stuff was the occupying army, the enemies of the zealots. And so Jesus challenges, double challenges, the zealot view. And he adds, well, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. If that's what it meant to be salt and light, then we can imagine any zealot struggling to be very sure as to whether they wanted a piece of that action. Jesus directly challenged the zealots by insisting that enemies were not to be hated. They were to be loved. It was wrong to resist them. Rather, the challenge was to get alongside them. Instead of trying to avoid their requests, the call of God is to pray for them. To not just meet their requests, but to do so with great generosity. And then thinking about other groups that these disciples would encounter, that would almost certainly include some Pharisees. They were the people of the Law. Torah, Torah, Torah. And at first it seems that all's going well. The disciples are to stand alongside them. Jesus is surely on their side. Do not think that I have come to abolish the Law or the Prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. So far, definitely so good for a Pharisee. Yeah, that's good. He's on our side. But Jesus makes it very clear that his view of the Law is very different from that taken by the Pharisees. What he says is, verse 20, and this is challenging, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And at first this seems just far too much. We know from elsewhere just how much detail that the Pharisees will engage in order to fulfill the Law. In Matthew 23:23, Jesus describes them as hypocrites for going to such ridiculous lengths. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you tithe mint, dill, and cumin. Though that's silly, there's no problem with it. The problem is what Jesus goes on to say, because he continues, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. Well, going back to Matthew 5 in the bit of the chapter beyond where we read, we've looked back to the earlier bit, now let's look on to the next bit. There are what might be seen as 6 case studies which explain things. Jesus was right there with the Pharisees so far as recognizing the importance of the law is concerned. But he came at it from a very different perspective. For the Pharisees, the law was effectively a restrictive thing. It told you what you should not do. For Jesus, the law was an enabling thing. It's positive. It was an indicator as to how you should behave, what you should do. Oh, the Pharisees following the law was pretty impressive. They went to such trouble. The problem was that they got so caught up in the tiny detail that they had entirely lost the big picture of justice, mercy, and love. They had worked out the definitions of all sorts of rules and regulations without taking account of the major principles on which it was all founded. Challenge provided by Jesus. And I think this applies to us just as much as to those first disciples. Is to stop seeing the law, the Torah, in the context of sin. In other words, as something that tells us to stop doing things that we shouldn't be doing. But rather, to see it in the context of kingdom. In other words, helping us to work out what we should be doing. And so building up God's kingdom values and enjoying God's abundant grace. And you know, if we take it that way, that is discipleship.